The story of Alice in Wonderland, and no, that's not the real title, is known so well in English-speaking culture that references to it abound. When you say down the rabbit hole or off with her head or talk about a Cheshire cat grin, you're making a reference to the book by Lewis Carroll, whose name was not in fact Lewis Carroll, but Charles Lutwidge Dodgson. And his book was not what it seems either. Our guest this hour tried to figure out what all the situations and people represented, and he delivers the answers in the new book, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Decoded. It's an annotated version of the original book. David Day is the author. He's a Canadian author and poet, the author of more than 40 books, including 7 looking into the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, the Hobbit author. The Encyclopedia of Vanished Species by David Day was called Book of the Year by Time Magazine, the LA Times, and New Scientist Magazine. David Day, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello, Jeff.
I understand there was to be a bit of a time hook to this project. 1998 was the 100th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's death. You wanted it done then, but it sounds like this project really grew.
Yes, I was commissioned to do it in 1996, and we thought, well, I thought 2 years is plenty of time. I'd just done a book on Tolkien, J.R. Tolkien, and I only had sort of 36,000 years of prehistory to deal with. And so I thought, well, how difficult can it be? This is a tiny book.
Right.
And little did I know, once I got into it, I mean, I'd read it as a child, like many people do, and I thought it was interesting. But as an adult reading it, I started reading it, and I thought, what the heck is going on here? I mean, like, we all know something about Alice, even if we've just seen the Disney film. There's a lot of things that are very peculiar about it. But I just had to go into the language, and I soon understood why James Joyce became so obsessed with it when he was doing Finnegan's Wake. He actually, there are hundreds of references to Alice in Finnegan's Wake, and he recognized a kindred spirit in terms of what he's doing with language. I started doing it, and I couldn't let go of it. I wrote other things during the trip, but it really took me 18 years to figure out what the heck was going on in
it. It seems like a piece of paper that every time you unfold it, you realize there's another fold inside of that fold.
That's right. It's like one of these Russian dolls where you open up and it keeps on going down. And, it's a curious thing. I mean, he was an Oxford mathematician, logician, clergyman, photographer, and there was a real life Alice who was, in fact, Alice Little, who was the daughter of Henry George Little, who was the dean of Christ Church College, where he was a math instructor. And it, everybody in just on one level, a historical one, everybody in Alice in Wonderland is somebody in Victorian society, usually connected with Oxford at the time. Alice's father and mother are the King and Queen of Hearts, while the caterpillar is Thomas de Quincey, the author of Confessions of an Opium Eater, which makes sense when you see him as a caterpillar with a hookah. Others like Bill the Lizard was a future Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, and Charles Dodgson, who's the real Lewis Carroll. He's the Dodo, because when he introduced himself in front of the children, he often stuttered. He had his stutter, and he would introduce himself as Mr. Dodgson. So it was a private joke with Alice and her sisters.
Well, I mean, Lewis Carroll, you mentioned Charles Dodgson's all the things he did in real life. I mean, for everything from math to photography to writing, obviously. And he seemed to be the kind of guy who had ideas for improving just about any system he found.
Yeah, he was a very peculiar man. I mean, he would everything he looked at. He learned to play cards at the age of 22, and 3 weeks later he invented 14 different card games. he decided the rules of whist weren't proper, so he rewrote them. He would do bizarre things, like he decided the British Rail wasn't running properly on timetables, so he rewrote the timetables and sent them to them. Of course, they sent them right back. But he developed systems for everything, and that's why he wrote books on logic, that's what I found really curious with him, was that when you write nonsense, nonsense doesn't make any sense unless it has a logical basis, because it's not funny. It's just chaos. And as any comedian will tell you, there has to be some sense of logical beneath everything. And as a mathematician and logician, that's sort of part of what he did. Like, big passages of what he's doing is based on a system called Boolean algebra, which actually is the binary system that all computers are based on, which explains why so many physicists and computer nerds are into Alice, that there is a kind of logic structure underneath it that appeals to them in a very, very logical way.
Was Alice's Adventures in Wonderland just completely different from anything that had come before it in British literature?
Yes, very much so. I mean, the point I make in this book, which I sort of like to point out, that it's the book, it won't come well over the radio, but the book itself is really a beautiful book. It's a gorgeously made out, and it gives you a sense of the whole 19th century of Victorian England. But it's based, really, the story of Alice in Wonderland. The original title was Alice's Adventures Underground. And it was based on the oldest story in the world, really, is the descent of the goddess into the underworld, which we know through Greek mythology is Persephone, the goddess of spring.
All right, I'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. We're talking about Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, decoded by David Day, which contains the full text of Lewis Carroll's novel and a lot of annotations about what was going on in there. Behind the scenes, in a sense. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails. We'll come back and talk to David Day and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Day, the author and poet and researcher, I guess we should add to that as well, because he put so much work into Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded, which is Lewis Carroll's complete book, along with a lot of annotations by David Day explaining what in God's name was going on behind the scenes, what Lewis Carroll had done to get here. Lewis Carroll, of course, being Charles Lutwidge Dodgson in real life. Join us on the Exchange with questions or comments. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You had just mentioned, David, that the original version, a much shorter version of this book, was Alice Underground. And it was essentially the story of somebody going into the underworld, which is a very ancient story.
Yeah, it's really the oldest written story we have. And it started in Mesopotamia with the goddess Inanna. Descending into the other world, and it went through virtually every civilization, up to the Greeks and the Romans. And for about 2,000 years, there was a cult in the Greco-Roman world where people would go to the temple of the goddess and relive her journey underground. And what Lewis Carroll's done, I mean, it's something that, in fact, is very similar to what the Masons' initiations are and the Rosicrucianists were secret societies in which you go through initiations and you visit these different tableaus where you learn something. And he's giving her a kind of journey of knowledge and these nonsensical encounters with the Mad Hatter and everything like that are sort of parodies of these the Greek gods and goddesses too. So you've got a whole mythological level at which it's operating as well as a kind of initiation rite for her.
So essentially, what he's doing is he's providing a bit of an education. It sounds like to
yes.
the real life.
I mean, essentially, my argument here is that. As a young girl, she's not going to be able to go to get a classical education at Oxford or any other place like that. There were educations for women, but they were not very good in that period. So he's really in a sort of a multi-level. There's sort of these multi-levels of knowledge that are sort of built in it, and he's subliminally giving her an education. And Wonderland, I sort of see as a memory palace. It's constructed in the way a cathedral is constructed, an analog of the world of all its secrets. And as a high churchman, Carroll believed in the mystical subliminal powers of the symbols and language. And as he said, he wanted to convey a higher truth straight to the soul, bypassing the intellect. So within the whole thing, he's giving her a classical education subliminally.
It's probably useful at this point to define classical education and what replaced it.
Yeah, a classical education included Greek and Roman material, but it was actually it would include mathematics and philosophy and theosophy and mythology. So he was really there. It works on about seven different levels, and it's one of the most complex pieces of writing I've ever encountered. And something that he quite often told the story that he just sort of thought it up on the spot while they were out in a rowing expedition along the Thames. But in fact, he spent 3 years sort of working it out in absolute detail. So you get all sorts of, even, you know, the, for instance, the descent down the rabbit hole is based on a mathematical concept. It's a kind of thought experiment employing Fibonacci numbers, which is a famous infinite series of numbers that were developed by the rate of the reproduction of pairs of imaginary rabbits. And so by drawing a graph or lattice using Fibonacci ratios, it's possible to construct the walls of a rabbit hole that will continue to allow Alice to descend through a gap of time and space all the way down through to infinity. So there's all these quite arcane material that's built into the whole adventure story.
I can't believe, and I didn't think to ask it until now, but given the way that he could process things in his brain, I mean, Dodgson sounds like he was a very quick mind. I can't imagine that any of this got into the book by accident. And so you see it as a complete design kind of thing.
Yes, he's someone who just, you know, he couldn't let go. Everything in his life seemed to be secrets. I mean, just his name, Lewis Carroll, it's actually, he's taken his first two names, Charles Ludwig. He translates that into Latin, saying Carolus Ludovicus. He reverses it around and puts it back into English, saying Lewis Carroll. But it's even more complex because behind that, Ludo, which we know the game Ludo, it means it's Latin for I play, and Carol is a joyous song. So it means his name, Lewis Carroll, means I play a joyous song, which is a quite wonderful name for a children's book author.
Absolutely. Lewis Carroll, of course, Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, the author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. David Day is the author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded. Bill and Arcata writes, what is the difference between this book and Martin Gardner's The Annotated Alice? Gardner was a famous mathematician in his day and for many years author of the Mathematical Gamers column in Scientific American.
Well, I think I go much deeper into the material. He's made his is a kind of a classic work. It was in 1960 he first did it, and it's been through various manifestations since then. It's sold about a million copies over the years, and he did a very good job. But he doesn't really deal with the actual how the tale works. I mean, how. He doesn't really analyze Dodgson's mind. I really had to get into Dodgson's psyche to do it. I mean, it was he's someone that I basically spent years sort of trying to understand how his mind worked. And you know, as I say, he was kind of an obsessive compulsive. I mean, he has a letter register that he kept where he's written 98,721 letters. And you have to keep in mind, he did this at a stand-up desk over the years. Fortunately for me, only a small part of those letters survived. Otherwise, I'd still be reading them.
Right, right.
But, I mean, basically, I had to read virtually everything he wrote, including his mathematical texts and everything. In the end, everything he also read, and by tracking down what he had in his library. So, I mean, that's why it took some time. My brother's a lawyer, and he said to me, he likes quoting the obvious, he said, it took you too long.
it took a while, that's for sure, but the level of detail.
Yeah, he bills by the hour.
Ah, okay. the level of detail is amazing, but you know, I'm starting to think about the way in which entertainment for children works on two levels anyway, just so the parents don't sit there yawning. There are things that they'll understand in today's animated classics, for example. So I wonder if as children were read to from Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and enjoyed just how silly things sounded, if adults at that time were getting what was going on behind it.
There was a certain level at which there was almost a guessing game from the beginning, because he was quite clear who Alice was and the connection there. Also, there was kind of a feud between the family and him. I mean, when he first wrote the first version of it, Alice's Adventures Underground, he did a handwritten version for Alice herself. But just at the point at which he gave her that book, there was some dispute with the parents, and they no longer allowed him to see Alice. So 2 years later, when the book comes out, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, the King and Queen of Hearts don't play a large part in Alice's Adventures Underground, but it's quite obvious that they are Alice's parents and are quite benign in the first version. But by the time 2 years later, he's a bit fuming over this dispute, and they turn very bad. The Queen's sort of homicidal maniac and screeching all over the place. So there is a And for many years afterwards, even among students, there were exchanges of letters and stuff relating to Lewis Carroll's feud with the family. So it was quite a public feud, and people were quite often looking at it in terms of that kind of internal politics of Oxford.
We're talking about Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded. David Day has taken Lewis Carroll's original novel, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and put copious annotations and revealed the many hidden meanings put in there by Charles Lutwidge Dodson, who wrote as Lewis Carroll. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. How old was Alice at the time the book came out, The Real World, Alice Little?
She was 12, I think, when it actually came out. She'll be 13, I guess, when it actually appeared. She was 10 when they were going down the river, and the beginnings of the story were told. Lewis Carroll was 30 at the time.
All right, so a grown man devoting some attention to Alice and her two sisters. But in the context of Victorian times, how usual or unusual was that?
At Oxford was fairly common. I mean, what you have to understand is that Oxford at that period, anybody going to Oxford, anybody teaching at Oxford, as in his case, was supposed to be celibate. It was a church institution largely. So all of the tutors, like Lewis Carroll, were bachelors. If they married, they'd be kicked out, as happened with his father, actually. When his father married, he was a tutor at Oxford, and he had to leave. So if Carroll wanted an academic career, he was bound not to marry. They seemed to practice. I mean, he was not the only one to take young girls out on the thing. The trouble is that from the age of about 12, you could get engaged to be married, and you couldn't respectfully, after the age of maybe 14 or 15, have much communication with young girls. So I think there was a kind of practicing gentleman behavior with young girls at that time that was accepted as just a chivalrous thing to do. Carroll was exceptional in that he more or less kept that attitude all of his life. I think, you know, there are all sorts of rumors about whether there was any kind of sexual innuendo. I think subliminally there was, But he, reading his letters and all of the material, I mean, he'd probably be in big trouble these days. But,
yeah, no doubt.
But then it didn't seem to bother many people so far as that kind of behavior. But he'd certainly had an obsession with young girls.
Hmm. So let's get into the some of the material in the book again. So Alice has this drink that makes her small and the cake that makes her big, and there's a bit of an identity crisis here as Alice changes size and shape. I mean, and as we go through this, especially when we get to the point where Alice is thinking of sending letters to her feet because she's so tall, the explanation you give makes me think of Kevin Spacey's character in The Usual Suspects, where just everything he sees around him becomes fodder for the story.
Yes, and it's. All of this, although it's curious, I mean, all of this is based on his views of mathematics too. I mean, the numbers on the, as I explained with the Fibonacci rabbit hole, when the number system allows her to descend into Wonderland, she gets out of it by way of the numbers on the Mad Hatter's hat, which are based on a historical formula known as Fermat's theorem, and it allows her to grow larger again. The whole thing is full of material like that. Probably the most curious one is the grin like a Cheshire cat. Like even in the Disney film, you see this grin floating in the air, and you wonder what it's about. Mm-hmm. She goes like I've seen a cat without a grin, but never a grin without a cat. Well, actually, she has. The expression "grin like a Cheshire cat" was around for about a couple of centuries before he wrote Wonderland.
Really?
But he says when the cat vanishes from tail to grin, we're informed that the grin remained for some time. The grin in geometry, Carroll would describe this shape as a catenary. A curve made by a chain suspended between two points. A suspension bridge is also called a catenary bridge because of the shape. So when Alice describes this operation of a grin without a cat, she's providing us with a mathematician's absurd solution to the ancient riddle, what kind of cat can grin? A catenary.
wow, that's some deep stuff in there.
Terrible pun extended from ordinary language into mathematics, and he does this frequently.
Well, there's another, all kinds of puns in here. When we get to sighs and tears, Alice is sighing and crying, but that also relates to sighs, S-I-Z-E, and tears, T-I-E-R-S.
Yes, and it's a pun he used frequently in these things, and it's to do with calculus and that was one of the difficulties I had was dealing with what mathematics was in 1850. So I was actually having to read mathematical books of the 1850s to understand what he was doing. But calculus deals with the infinitely large and the infinitely small, and that's what he's playing with her. He's applying rules of calculus all the way through of her growth and shrinking away. And it's one of these. It's a sort of a constant all the way through until she can learn how to control it by learning the basis of calculus. Like when she's eating the mushroom, it's based on mushroom pi, the symbol pi for mathematics, and her ability to control growth and get some sort of control over her own life like that.
You mentioned the caterpillar representing a man who'd written a book about taking opium, and we did get an anonymous call who wanted to know if there were any truth to the rumors of Lewis Carroll or Charles Dodgson using drugs himself, cocaine perhaps.
Well, if anything, it would be laudanum or opium, which was very commonly used. But there's nothing in his diaries and his letters or anything like that to suggest it wouldn't be a great sin, particularly, to use opium at the time. People used it all the time for toothaches and things like that. But I think very much I was reading his diaries and his notebooks and stuff, and he was, for instance, when he was at Christ Church for 1 year. He wrote his reading for literature that year was going to be Shakespeare and Thomas De Quincey. Thomas De Quincey, who was the author of The Confessions of an English Opium Eater, was wrote extensively on his experience, on drug experiences. And when I compare in the book passages of De Quincey with Alice's more surreal moments, and you sort of realize that Lewis Carroll is getting his information about this kind of surrealism through Thomas De Quincey's books.
Getting a contact high, as it were, from Thomas De Quincey. Good way to look at it. We'll take a break and talk more about Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded, which is the full text of Lewis Carroll's novel with all sorts of explanations, and you've heard many so far that just boggle the mind, provided by David Day, the Canadian author who's put this all together and spent 18 years researching it. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange, and take your phone calls and emails. Back with David Day and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Day, the Canadian author and poet, the author of more than 40 books. His latest is Alice in Wonderland, which, of course, is not the real title. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded. It's all of Lewis Carroll's book, plus all of the annotations indicating all of the things that David Day was able to research about what the meanings of all that stuff and all those characters are. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a phone call from Cynthia in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Day. Okay, I can hear somebody listening to the radio there. We're going to have to get that person back on the horn and advise them that you don't listen to the radio because you end up 10 seconds late to take your phone call. So let's come back to the book itself. We talked about the characters representing real people. Do any of the characters switch sources through the book, represent one person perhaps, and then another, David?
I think quite often they're composite ones. When I was writing the book, I ended up writing five different books, actually, because I had to sort of sort out the different levels of who's who. And there are many that have multiple identities. And so I've had to sort of break them up to give you a sense of these kind of multiple levels. And But the one that people usually attach onto are the ones that Alice would have known in circles in Oxford. One of the more interesting ones is the Duchess Kitchen, where Alice goes into a kitchen where everybody's fighting. And the ugly Duchess is Samuel Wilberforce, who's the Bishop of Oxford, and the cook is Dr. Richard Owen, who's a man who first invented the word dinosaur. But both of them were opponents of Charles Darwin. And it's about this at that time at Oxford, there was a great Darwin debate between Wilberforce and Huxley, who was Darwin's champion and was known as Darwin's bulldog. He appears as the puppy in the book. This was like a real turning point in the education system at Oxford at the time, because Alice's father was brought in as a liberal. Although he was an aristocrat, he was very much a liberal teacher and wanted to separate, really, the church and the education system. And he was arguing, basically, for the rise of science during that time. Charles Dodson himself was very much of the opposite. He came in as a member of the church. And really wanted to keep the institution the way it was, and this is a source of a lot of the conflict between them. was that Dodgson was basically on the wrong side of history for everything, almost. I mean, he was incredibly progressive as a writer, but in politics, the American Civil War was happening at that time, and he was on the side of the Confederates in it. So you can imagine all of the different conflicts happening there, and the whole aspect of it. I mean, the other aspect is of course, you also had to be a high Anglican church to go to Oxford at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was the majority of England, in fact, was not high Anglican anymore. So there was all sorts of conflicts and changes that were happening at that time.
It's really interesting to think he could do such a groundbreaking work and be a man of science and math and yet resist the change in education itself.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, he actually resigned his teaching of mathematics at one point because Alice's father brought in rulings not requiring, for instance, engineering students to learn Greek, because I guess Dodgson thought that the bridge would fall down if you didn't learn Greek. But the whole attitude was that he really, really for preserving Oxford in its old form, and it just wasn't possible anymore. The demands of the British Empire, you know, required engineers who didn't speak Greek.
I mean, in fact, a lot of courses were taught at Latin well into that time, weren't they?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, when he first became a tutor in 1855, the very first Matthew Arnold became the poet in residence, the Oxford poet, that year, and he was the first professor to actually deliver his lectures in English rather than in Latin. So it was really the whole even the servants had to conduct Latin at that time.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's see if we can get Cynthia and Ashlyn back on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Day, the author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland Decoded. Cynthia, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Thank you. David, I have a question for you that may be a bit uncomfortable. It's been uncomfortable for me for some years. I was in Seattle some years ago and a student at the U and went to the bookstore and saw there at the university bookstore a beautiful volume of Lewis Carroll's photographs of the girls that he was writing for, Alice mm-hmm. and her sisters. And they were nude, and the girls had dark circles under their eyes, and they did not look happy. They looked rather bedraggled. I wondered if that practice or that event, if it was only one, was at the root of the dispute with the parents, and I'll take my answer off the radio thing.
All right. Thank you for that, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
That wasn't the reason for the conflict. In fact, we don't exactly know because the pages of his diary over that weekend have disappeared. The photography of him, I mean, quite often those things were based on, for instance, the one that she's talking about was really one that was based on one of Tennyson's stories. Called the Beggar Girl, and she was purposely made to look like a beggar girl with a torn dress and stuff like that. But it's interesting. I did an interview a long time ago with Alice's great granddaughter, who was who became a writer herself, and she was a dead ringer for Alice when she was the age of 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
And they constantly took pictures of her posing in many of the photographs that Alice took of, or Lewis Carroll took of Alice. And she said she thought that Alice looked quite sultry in this one outfit, but she said all she managed to look was like resentful because she spent 4 hours putting makeup on and stuff. I guess the kind of tradition if you look at even the paintings and everything of that period, nude children were quite often, not that he photographed Alice in the nude, but he did photograph other children in the nude. And nude paintings of children were quite common, actually, in Victorian times. There were sort of there's a kind of cult of the child that was happening at that time. But anyway, to answer your question, I don't think that was a factor in it. I'm not sure that the parents would even have seen those photographs.
The way that you take us a little further into what Dodgson did in his real life outside of the pages of his famous books, he sounds almost like Michael Jackson in a sense that he just wanted to have friendships with children.
Yeah. I think that kind of obsession. I'm a little less sure of Michael Jackson myself than Lewis Carroll, but. There's that kind of element. It's really interesting, actually, though. For instance, at the end of Alice's life, when she was 80 years old, she was sent to Britain. She was sent to New York because it was the 100th anniversary of Lewis Carroll's birth, and she was quite famous throughout the world at that time as the real Alice from Alice in Wonderland. And they gave her an honorary doctorate at Columbia University for being the inspiration of it. She returned to England, and they had another event there at a famous bookstore in London. And she, at that point, there was a young gentleman came in his 30s to meet Alice, and he was the original Peter from Peter Pan.
Huh.
So there we had right towards the end of her life, the real Alice and the real Peter met up, and they're both products of that kind of desire to never grow up. I mean that Lewis Carroll's always thought of himself. Once he got to be about 20 years old, he started thinking of himself as an old man, that he'd lost his youth. In fact, wrote quite a few poems about just if he could just live for as a child for an hour, it'd be a wonderful thing to go back to that sort of innocence. I'm not sure entirely. Like, I mean, what one actress who was a good friend of his later in life, and she was unusual in that they were still friends when she was in her 20s. But it was saying that at times she didn't really think he so idealized childhood that he didn't really have a sense of what children were, because he saw them as profoundly innocent, and she didn't think she was that innocent as a child.
So. Huh. Was there ever a whiff of scandal for Charles Lutwidge Dodgson in his lifetime?
There became a stage at which what's interesting is that he was sort of a lower middle class. And actually, his means of sort of social climbing, I suppose you might say, was the photography. It was only in 1854-50 that the copyright allowed individuals to use this collodion plate method, which was a new method of photography, which is transportable. He became one of the first early photographers that could use this method, and he was a very good photographer, specifically of children. But he used it as a vehicle to meet all sorts of celebrities, because before that, of course, you either had to get a photograph or you had to get a portrait painter to come in. And so it was a very popular form to have, but you almost had to be a chemistry major to do it. It was a very complex process. But he was such a sort of... He was very much into that process and liked these complex processes of development. And so he would actually go to people he normally could not have made contact with, and it would be socially unacceptable. As a photographer, he went to, met all the pre-Raphaelites, took their photographs, met all the heads of churches and things like that. And he usually did it by approaching them, saying he'd like to take pictures of their children. And then he worked his way up. And with the situation, for instance, the big literary lion of the period was Tennyson. And for him to and Tennyson was notoriously shy about and secretive, and wouldn't normally have been approachable. But he went and tracked him down in the Lake District through a contact with his wife. Then offered to take the photographs, and then pursued him all the way down to the Isle of Wight later on, and caught him out in the open, you know, cutting his lawn. Eventually, got a photograph of him. So he was a very much a someone who, through his life, was his early life was very outgoing, and would try to, you know, develop contacts that would help him. But once he became famous himself, he became totally reclusive, and anybody who came around asking for him was, you know, sort of kicked off the campus basically. Or you know, and he wouldn't answer letters unless he had proper introductions. So it only seemed to work one way with him then.
And he never did marry, did he?
No, he never married, and he had I think six or seven sisters that were all unmarried as well. He had two brothers. One of was on. Way off in Tierra del Fuego as a churchman.
Wow, it's an amazing life and an amazing story. And the adventures of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland get that much more magnified by the decoding that has been applied by David Day in this book. David, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson
Thank
Exchange.
You.